What's up, guys? It's Albert. We're going to kick things off with my five takeaways from week 13. Then we get into mid-season awards with our special guests. And as always, we'll wrap things up with your questions. Let's go. All right, welcome in. Week 13 is in the books. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We got a great guest in again this week to break down our three-quarter season awards. You don't hear very many people doing those. We're going to bring those to you. MVP, offensive player, defensive rookie, offensive rookie, and coach of the year. All of that's coming up. We're going to start, as we always do, with the takeaways. And my number one takeaway from week 13, the Baltimore Ravens proving their mettle in the rain, in adverse conditions, when things weren't quite right. They showed how tough they are. And I talked to Mark Ingram after the game about this, and he said, we feel like we're the toughest team in the league, but we needed a place to show it, and this provided them that opportunity. They didn't score a point in the second half until when they were midway through the fourth quarter. They get the ball in the 35. Lamar Jackson probably and maybe his worst game of the year to this point, right? The running game wasn't rolling quite the way it had been rolling. They were on 6 days rest. Again, it's raining sheets there in Baltimore. And they pick up a fourth and one. They drive another 30 yards. They set up Justin Tucker for the game-winning field goal. And so, yes, this one was different than it has been. And this isn't scoring in the 40s and holding the Texans to single digits. This isn't scoring in the 40s and holding the Rams to single digits. This isn't beating the Super Bowl champion Patriots by double digits. It's not any of that. It might be more valuable because they were pushed, things weren't perfect, and they were able to keep the train on the tracks and pull it out when it really mattered. And so I thought that was a fantastic show of toughness and grit and all those things that you need when you get to the playoffs. Baltimore looks very, very legit, the number one team in the league right now. Number two, the Houston Texans are suddenly interesting. And I think Bill O'Brien's done a nice job with the changing personnel there. The offensive line's sort of been a work in progress all year. For most of the year, you're starting two rookies, Titus Howard, Max Sharping. Titus obviously goes out for the year now. Before the game against the Patriots. You've got a newcomer in Laremy Tunsil at left tackle. You brought in Kenny Stills. He's got a role in the offense. The running back situation was in flux over the course of the spring and the summer. And now you got Carlos Hyde and Duke Johnson, two guys who weren't on the team in the spring. There is the lead horses. And they've been able to bring all of that together. And the defense hasn't been great. But considering the circumstances, you trade Clowney before the year and then, you know, you lose J.J. Watt for the season. It's just, I think that there's a resourcefulness to the job that Bill O'Brien's done in pulling all the right levers. And now they're at 8-4 and Deshaun Watson's playing well. And there's a real identity to them, to what they're doing offensively. And they're scratching and clawing and fighting on defense. And so, do I think they're going to the Super Bowl? No. But what I saw on Sunday night in beating the Patriots, the way they beat the Patriots, they really dominated that game, goes a long way. Number three, the Seattle Seahawks again look like the sort of team, and I know we're not paying a ton of attention to them, but it feels to me like sort of what's happening with them is what we saw happen with the Ravens 3 or 4 weeks ago, where things started to come together for the Ravens. Early in the year, the Ravens had some flaws. The defense wasn't great. They were sort of hit or miss, Pat throwing the ball at times. And everything sort of came together at once for the Ravens. And it feels like the same sort of thing's happening with the Seahawks. Earlier in the year, Russell Wilson had to carry that team. And that's why he was my half-season MVP. And you'll find out if he's the three-quarter season MVP in just a minute. But he was really carrying that team and making it work with guys who weren't on the roster last year, guys like Jacob Hollister and DK Metcalf. And he's bought what basically he did was he bought Pete Carroll and his coaching staff time to get everything else right. And you saw the running game working on Monday night behind Chris Carson, and a guy that a lot of people had left for dead, Rashad Penny. And now you're starting to see the defensive additions add up. guys like Jadeveon Clowney and Quandre Diggs looked very, very comfortable in the defense last night, Monday night. And then you've got younger players who've bounced back after having some ups and downs. Shaq Griffin's the guy I'm looking at. They're corner who I think will be in Pro Bowl consideration. So a lot coming together there for the Seahawks. Is one reason to consider Russell Wilson for MVP is that he bought them the time to get the rest of this right. All right, number four, Gardner Minshew is the quarterback again in Jacksonville. And I remember last week, a couple weeks ago, we talked about Ryan Finley and why the Bengals were giving Ryan Finley his shot. And really the reason why was because they knew they weren't going anywhere this year. They needed to get a full evaluation of Ryan Finley ahead of making any sort of decisions in 2020 in the quarterback position. And on paper, that might be what this looks like, but I'm told that's not really what this is about. Is it a side benefit that the organization gets to look at a young quarterback, gets a four-week sample size, like looking at a young quarterback and his development before making decisions in 2020 on what they're going to do with that position? Absolutely, it's a side benefit. But for the guys in that building, they don't know if they're going to be the ones making that decision. Doug Marrone, Tom Coughlin, Dave Caldwell, they don't know that they're going to be the ones making those decisions on the quarterback position in 2020. They don't know if they're going to be there. My understanding is the reason Gardner Minshew is the starting quarterback is because they really believe right now, that speaks well of him, that he gives them the best chance to win. They've had issues in protection. That offensive line hasn't played up to the level that you would expect that it should play up to based on where a lot of those guys were drafted and how they were paid. You know, and that's Norwell and Linder and, you know, Robinson and Taylor at the tackles. They felt like they needed somebody more mobile back there. Right now for Coughlin and Caldwell and Marrone, it's about winning games because they need their jobs are on the line. And they feel like Minshew gives them the best chance to do it, which again, it's a little something there for Minshew that this quickly he's become that guy. Finally, number five, the Dallas Cowboys are on the ropes. They will play Thursday night in Chicago in what probably isn't a must-win because the NFC East has been so bad that it feels like an 8-8 team is going to win it. The Eagles and the Cowboys have been sort of falling back and forth with like every week one or the other or both are laying an egg, and so they've sort of kept each other in it. So maybe it's not a must win, but I mean, I thought the optics were really, really bad on Thanksgiving for Jason Garrett, missing a couple field goals, getting one blocked just a few days after Jerry Jones had publicly criticized the special teams and pinned that problem on the coaching staff. And so right now, there's no question Dallas. There's no question Jason Garrett's fighting for his job, and he is in such a unique spot because his contract's up. Coaches usually don't get to that point where they're a lame duck, and being in that position means either they can let you go for nothing, they don't have to pay you another dime, so there's not the deterrent, there's no financial deterrent to letting you go, or they've got to give you a brand new contract, which in most cases is going to mean committing $30 or $40 million to a guy. That's why the bar is high for Jason Garrett, because if they're going to keep him, they got to double down on him. They got to almost remarry him. And it's going to be tough for him to hang on to his job, especially with the Jones family having eyes for guys like Lincoln Riley and Urban Meyer. All right, we're going to get to our guests right after this. All right, so I was actually thinking earlier about how we always do quarter season awards and we do half season awards, but nobody ever does three quarter season awards. And that's why we're going to bring in my buddy Gresh from WPRO in Providence. And Gresh, like, do you understand why we never do three quarter season awards? Everybody wants to do it after four games, after eight games, but this time of year you never get that. And that's where we're at right now, 4 weeks left.
Yeah, it is a little odd there, friend, and thanks for the ask to come on. I always love coming on the pod, and yeah, it is weird. You know, we're taught here in New England, where you and I are based, at least according to that, you know, Bill B. Hoodsworth guy, is that the final four games of the regular season really matter, and you're trying to ramp up for that. So why wouldn't we look at some of the people who would be sitting at the three-quarter poll? It's kind of like Secretariat, right? You know, like, we're at the three-quarter poll, and let's see who pulls away.
No question. Okay, so we're going to do the six, what I consider the six majors. And the six major awards, the MVP award, offensive player award, defensive player award, offensive rookie award, defensive rookie award, and the coach of the year award. And we're going to do this in the order that I think will best set up so there's less overlap here. And so I'm going to start with the MVP. And my MVP, Gresh, is Lamar Jackson. And to me, it was like more about the influence that he has over every game, the influence he has over every defense that he plays against. And I'm telling you, 2 weeks ago, I was still Russell Wilson. After Monday night, I sort of feel like Russell Wilson's creeped back up into it. And I am a little bit, there's part of me that looks at this and says, well, they're doing so much for him schematically. And that's like a really, really, like the offense is set up perfectly for him. And Seattle maybe doesn't have quite as well-rounded a talent base on that side of the ball as Baltimore does. But it's just, I mean, Lamar's been such a force of nature. He's gotten so much better as a passer. You know, we've seen what sort of, again, like even when it's like, you know, there have been games where he's had like maybe 250 yards combined rushing and passing, and it still feels like he's influencing and affecting every part of what the defense does. So for me, I went with Lamar Jackson here, but it was tougher than it would have been last week. Last week, I was like, okay, like this is really starting to be Lamar. This week, you know, the Ravens found a different way to win against the Niners. I thought Russell looked great on Monday night, and so it's a little closer than it was, but I'm going with Lamar.
I'm going to stick with Russell Wilson. I had him, I do believe, when we did this at the halfway point. And for me, Bert, what I saw on Monday Night Football was beyond impressive for Russell Wilson, and it's the ability to operate when plays break down. To your point in terms of what they've done in Baltimore, it feels like that if the rhythm and the timing of that offense is thrown off a little bit, then it's up to Lamar Jackson to kind of run around, get into the scramble drill, make plays. And Russell Wilson, to me, still looks to get the ball down the field in those situations. I mean, on that Monday night game, he had the one, I mean, a free rusher came right at him, and he pump faked him out of his jock and then rolls out of the pocket to complete a pass. You know, Lamar Jackson makes that play a little more differently. I think operating within their system, Russell Wilson has been dynamic. This is to take nothing away from Lamar Jackson, and I do think there is a fad element to Lamar Jackson that people will catch up with. But, man, Russell Wilson has been pretty good. You know, and I think there's another guy kind of creeping up in this race here, Bert, who might be able, through the next 4 weeks, might be able, depending on where his team finishes and how he finishes, to get in this race, and that's Aaron Rodgers from Green Bay. But there may be a little bit of that Tom Brady take him for granted kind of factor there to where he doesn't get those votes.
Is there anybody who's not a quarterback who you'd look at?
Whoa, boy. You know, I'm just looking at the stats here real quick, and McCaffrey would probably be the only other guy in the mix. And unfortunately for him, I think as the Carolina Panthers start to play more and more meaningless games, people will start to forget that McCaffrey is having like a Marshall Faulk type season when you really look at it.
Okay, so, and I think I actually like, you know what, that I think that's the right comparison for him. I think the right comp for Christian McCaffrey is and has been Marshall Faulk. Like, I think that that's the player that he's probably most like because he is capable of being an every down back on top of all the stuff that he does in the passing game, which is very Faulk-ish. The reason I asked the question, though, is because the one guy I would consider is my offensive player of the year, and that is Michael Thomas from the New Orleans Saints. And it had been Christian McCaffrey, and it's close. It's definitely close. Christian McCaffrey right now has got 1,811 all-purpose yards, yards from scrimmage, 1,167 on the ground, and 644 receiving. That's fantastic. That is, like again, like for a running back, just very, very good all-around numbers. Michael Thomas right now is leading the league in catches with 110, right? You know who's next?
DeAndre Hopkins, I think.
With 86.
Oh, my God.
He's leading by 24 catches right now, 12 games in. That means he's catching the ball two times per game more than anyone else in the NFL, okay? He's also leading the NFL in yards with 1290. He's more than 100 clear of Chris Godwin from Tampa, who's second. Believe it or not, the second and third guys in yards are both Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And he's got six touchdowns. And I think, to me, like part of this, too, is there's a value element to this, too. And that's why I say he's the one guy I might consider for MVP. And McCaffrey would have been there, too, if it hadn't been for the Panthers falling out of contention. This is one of the best teams in football. This is a team that's competing for the number one seed in the NFC. And they did it with a quarterback injury. They did it without Drew Brees for 6 weeks. And Teddy Bridgewater came in, and Michael Thomas's numbers didn't drop off. And they rely on him in big spots. And I think there are so many examples of it, Gresh. And to me, the best one was, I think it was a 3rd and 6 against the Panthers. The Saints were on the ropes. They hadn't played all that well, sort of a sloppy game against the Panthers a couple weeks ago. Everyone in the Superdome knows where the ball is going, right? And to me, the definition of a dominant receiver is when everybody knows where the ball is going, the ball still goes there and the guy still catches it. And that's what Michael Thomas did. He beat his man. He shook free of the double team, caught the ball on the sideline, 24 yards, first down, even though everyone knew where the ball was going.
I love Michael Thomas. I think in terms of the MVP race, if he had 10 or 11 touchdowns versus 6,
yeah,
that might stand out a little bit more amongst all these wide receivers. And you know how this is going, and you and I both talked to people on the committee for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. There's now, 100 catches was something.
Yeah, it was.
Now we're probably going to end up with 10 guys who are going to come close to 100 catches in a year. So I think the receiver position, unfortunately, is being scrutinized in a way where you have to get in the end zone and put up those kinds of numbers. Everything you said about Michael Thomas is spot on. He has been far and away the best wide receiver in the NFL this year. And I think you make a great point on the whole getting the ball. It's like, hey, we know the ball's going here, but this guy's still going to find a way to get open. And in terms of McCaffrey, again, there's so much Marshall Faulk in his game. It's the modern day version of him. I'm still going Lamar Jackson with the offensive player of the year. Only because he, to your point earlier, he has gotten better at throwing the ball. His ability to run the ball in between the tackles is what has really stood out to me, Bert, in that where normally this is a guy who you would think pressing the edges, running the options, stuff like that. No, when they run the ball, they run between the tackles with him, and he's been very effective in doing so. You know, it's
he's ninth in the league in rushing.
I mean that is
insane.
No, it really is, and I think that as you know, it's funny. And look, you know, we remember that Patriot game a couple of weeks ago, and it felt like there was a lot of emptying the tank from the Baltimore offense in terms of what they did against New England, because New England's got a great player in Stephon Gilmore, who you would think would have the ability to deal with Hollywood Brown. It's really about making sure Lamar Jackson didn't beat him in the run game, and they ran the ball consistently. They churned it that night on offense. But when they threw the ball, they really got into the whole using the tight ends. And Houston did that against New England the other night as well. And I wonder where the limits are to that offense. And that's why I went with Wilson as the MVP and Jackson as the offensive player of the year. I'm not saying Russell Wilson can't be stopped, don't get me wrong, but if you take away the running game, he'll still throw for 450 yards and do it within the context of the offense and not running around little Dougie Flutie going crazy kind of thing. I wonder about that Baltimore offense, if there is a ceiling, if someone can do a good job of slowing down the run game and forcing Lamar Jackson to throw the ball within the system. But I do think, Bert, with 4 weeks to go, we're now maybe more than ever able to narrow down these candidates as to who could win what awards, because we just have so much offense in the league right now. Like, you know, there's in terms of catches, it's Michael Thomas, DeAndre Hopkins, Julian Edelman is third. And then you get to Keenan Allen, Christian McCaffrey, and Chris Godwin and people like that. You also have some guys on some teams that aren't very good putting up numbers. And I think the better the team you play on, sort of separates you from the rest of the pack.
No question. All right. The next award is, I would say, the toughest one on the board for me. And the guy that I had winning this award is no longer playing. And so that makes it even more difficult. That's the Defensive Player of the Year. My Defensive Player of the Year a month ago was Myles Garrett. For obvious reasons, Myles Garrett is no longer my Defensive Player of the Year.
Of course.
And in the non-swinging helmet category of Defensive Player of the Year award candidates, I'm going to go with Stephon Gilmore. I just think, Gresh, he enables so much of what New England has been able to become defensively, and they're the number one defense in the league. And I know sometimes it's a little unfair the way that we judge defensive players. It's always got to be – it's not like so much individual performance. A lot of times, like, your team has to be – your unit has to be great for you to get this award, right? But his unit's great. You know, there's that. I think he's the best corner in football. They trusted him on Sunday night with DeAndre Hopkins, which I think says a lot on what they think of him. He can play zone. He can play man. You know, so much of what they're able to do and so much of how they're able to be creative with their front, so much of how they're able to mix coverages is having a player like Stephon Gilmore. I don't think the Patriots are who they are defensively without having Stephon Gilmore back there, which is why he's the highest paid guy in the bunch. And so my Defensive Player of the Year, tough one, is a tough one. I mean, I'd say there's no like obvious candidate this year that really jumps out at you, but there are a lot of good players who could be in the mix. You know, Shaq Barrett down in Tampa, Chandler Jones, who's not playing for a very good defense right now. He's a perfect example of a guy who's having a great year but not playing on a very good defense. Bobby Wagner in Seattle, you know, fantastic as always. But I'm going with Stephon Gilmore as my Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, last time out I had Gilmore, and the hard part for a lot of the people who are going to vote on these kinds of awards is Stephon Gilmore is, you're going to have to talk about the 30,000 foot view, excuse me, as to what he provides to the Patriots defense, because from a metrics and numbers standpoint, you're not going to be able to justify it.
Right.
Bobby Wagner, the numbers jump out, right? Couple of passes defended. He's forced a fumble. He's got a fumble recovery. He does have a sack. He's got 115 tackles as we talk here today on a Seattle defense that has beat some pretty good teams and has done a good job of at times trying to hang in there. And I think that's the leadership of Wagner getting them through. Now, I know KJ Wright, who plays, you know, near him, is having a hell of a year as well. But to your point, we sort of mentioned it in the Offensive Player of the Year discussion in terms of the how good is your team.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of guys who have a lot of sacks, but a lot of those guys who have those sacks aren't on really good teams. Like, yep. I'm looking at the list, and you got – I mean, Cam Jordan is the one guy that stands out.
Yeah, Cam Jordan was a consideration for me because I think that, like, they're a very good defense. They become a very good defense, and he's at the center of everything.
No doubt. And T.J. Watt's having a nice year, but Pittsburgh really isn't. You know, you got – so in terms of the sackers, you really don't have a lot of guys that are playing on really good teams. And to your point, it does make this difficult because if you try to explain Stephon Gilmore to someone who hasn't watched every game of the Patriots, it's hard to understand what he means because there isn't the metrics to be able to quantify his value. But man, Bobby Wagner has played really well. He may end up with 150 tackles this year on a team that, by the way, may end up finding their way to the number one or the number two seed, and they play in the same division as the 49ers. That's really telling.
Before we move on to the rookies, I just want to throw this name at you and see what your reaction is.
Yep.
Minka Fitzpatrick.
You know, that's an interesting one because I thought, what the hell are the Steelers doing giving a first round pick for this guy here when Roethlisberger's hurt? And it's funny, I talked about this on my show the other night, in that normally when you make a move like that, Bert, you're thinking Super Bowl, right? I mean, look at like what Houston did. Houston emptied the tank. They added another wide receiver. They get the left tackle that's been evading them forever. They paid a high price. But in their mind, it was, if we're going to beat New England, if we're going to get to the Super Bowl, this is what we have to do. To me, it was more of the, all right, we know there's a sale going on, and let's go get this guy because we haven't been able to replace Troy Polamalu. And God dang, if it hasn't worked on a really high level, because the Steelers ain't scoring a ton of points. You know, they're a little like New England. They're doing it with defense and special teams. And it's an interesting point, Bert. I think Pittsburgh would have to run the table or come close.
Yeah.
But if the Steelers, but if the Steelers make the playoffs, you're right. That's somebody you would have to consider.
I would just like the reason I bring it up is because they're fifth in total defense. They're sixth in scoring defense. Their defense has been a problem for a long time, right? Like they coming out of that, Ike Taylor, Troy Polamalu, Ryan Clark, James Harrison, James Ferrier, like that era, right? Like they've really had, it's taken them time to rebuild the defense. And at a time when they really needed the defense to break through with the injury to Ben Roethlisberger, it has broken through. And what's the new piece? The new piece is Minka, right? Like, so that's the part of it that I look. And they've got good players over there, too. I mean, T.J. Watt's a good player. Devin Bush, I think, is going to be a really good player. Cam Hayward and Stephen Tuitt on the D-line. Joe Hayden's been a nice pickup as a corner. I just, you know, Minka seems to me like the almost like the guy that brought it all together. And so I just thought he'd be an interesting guy to consider based on, again, the fact that the Steelers needed their defense to be better. And it has been better. And I think a lot of it being better is having that sort of movable piece, the guy who can do a little bit of everything. By the way, guy who is also, scouts would tell you, Nick Saban's favorite player ever. Tells you a little bit who he is. Yeah. The scouts who'd go through Alabama would tell you that, and that was one reason why Kevin Colbert wound up really, really seeing him as, you know, a priority as a trade target. Kevin Colbert's one of these guys who spends a ton of time on the road and has all kinds of connections at the college level. And so the fact that Nick Saban valued Minka Fitzpatrick that way and looked at Minka Fitzpatrick that way, it went a long way with Colbert.
Wow, that's interesting. That will be an interesting study in a month as to what the Steelers' defense looked like pre- and then post-Minka Fitzpatrick, because you're right, he's made a huge difference.
Okay, offensive rookie of the year. I'm going to stick with my pick on that one. Josh Jacobs, 1,200 yards from scrimmage, 1,061 rushing. I know the Raiders have sort of fallen off a little bit. You know, and I think you can make an argument for certain guys. Kyler Murray, despite the team not having great success, has been, I'd say, has been impressive in spots. You know, you've got guys who flash like DK Metcalf, but to me, you know, I look at it and I just see the very consistent production on offense, and it's coming from Josh Jacobs.
Well, I think for these rookies of the year, it's going to be teams that are going to provide them opportunity. So you take the whole, you know, team element out of it, I guess you would say. And you're right. It's really down to two in my mind. It's either Kyler Murray or it's Josh Jacobs. And, you know, I'm looking at the wagering line right now where Josh Jacobs is a small favorite over Kyler Murray. I think this one is wide open. Here's the reason I'm going to go with Kyler Murray. And it's purely not because of wins and losses or things like that. Is because, quite honestly, Bert, I thought by this time, this offense in Arizona would have fallen apart a little bit. That Kyler Murray would have been completely frustrated and exposed. And he's been better than I thought he was going to be. And when you're the number one pick and you're the number one pick of a team who is for 2 years completely botched the draft in ways unfathomable and fired a coach and all that kind of stuff. Kyler Murray came in with everybody knowing he was supposed to be really good, and he's been rookie good. He hasn't been great. He's had his moments. He doesn't have a ton of people around him, but he's been better than I thought. Jacobs, on the other hand, I mean, come on, you know, it's kind of easy to make the case for him, but a lot of it is volume of carries. And hey, look, if the Raiders play three games where they get down, then the Josh Jacob numbers are going to go down and you may look at him a little differently in a month or so. Whereas with Kyler Murray, I'm not going to say he's, there have been some moments where he's been up and down, but you can kind of see the growth there a little bit. I've actually been impressed with this guy in a way that I didn't think I would be at the beginning of the year, because I do think there is a little bit of a fad element to their offense as well. That said, I'm going Kyler Murray right now, but let's see where we're at in a month, because both guys, we would agree that both guys are going to end up with the good seasons. But does Kyler Murray make a push here down the final month? And can the Raiders continue to run the ball here in the final month for Jacobs to stay on the radar?
You know, I will say this. DK Metcalf has an interesting case. He's 44 catches, 705 yards, 5 touchdowns for a contending team, and a team that really needed him. I don't think he's going to win it. I think, you know, he'll probably wind up finishing third. But for a guy who, I'll say it myself, like, I questioned what he was coming out. Kind of like felt like he was, I guess the way you would put it would be all hat and no cattle, right? Like that, like he was sort of like, he was all sort of like, it was all show with him, and he didn't have the production in college. He's been really productive for the Seahawks.
Let me throw this at you, okay? And I know we're doing offensive, and the defensive rookie of the year will be a short discussion, which is why I bring this up.
Yep.
Where we don't do like special teams rookie or anything like that, and I kind of understand it. However, could I make an argument that Patriots punter Jake Bailey, in the year that he has had, deserves some sort of special recognition? I'm not saying he's an offensive or a defensive weapon. Honestly, I wouldn't know how to term him, but like the other night, he just had 3 punts. There were touchbacks, and he had 2 going into the season, or 2 going into the game. What was it, against Baltimore? I think it might have been.
Yeah.
Like, that guy has been as big a part of saving the Patriots' offensive inefficiencies as anybody. And let me take you back to when the Ravens won the Super Bowl with Brian Billick, and they did it with defense. Their punter, Richardson, was arguably, you could have made an argument that he was a candidate for Super Bowl MVP because of what he did in the kicking game and manipulating field position and setting up that defense. I know it's off the exit ramp a little bit and it's different kind of thinking, but it just goes to show how if you have a punter who is really good and can keep the ball out of the end zone, that guy can become a weapon and a part of what you need to play complementary football to have a chance to win in the league.
I'd agree with that. And it is sort of, I never thought about that, but there is no award for that. For if a punter or a kicker is the best rookie in the league, there's no award for it. So
right,
sort of
because we've seen rookie kickers come in and do great jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's rare that it's a punter. And again, if the Patriots offensively were the juggernaut that they normally are, we wouldn't even think about Jake Bailey in this context. Right. But if you go back and you look at the New England Patriots in 2001, that's how they're trying to win this year. Defense, hope you get enough offense, play great special teams, and that's where your punter and kicker come into play.
So the defensive rookie of the year discussion, like you said, will be short. There are good candidates here. I will say this. Like, Devin Bush has been fantastic for the Steelers, leading all rookies in tackles and in interceptions, believe it or not. Max Crosby, as a fourth-round pick, has been a revelation in Oakland. The actual leader in sacks among rookies is Josh Allen down in Jacksonville. But, I mean, I don't think anybody's come close among the rookies to having the sort of impact that we've seen from Nick Bosa in San Francisco. And I know they already had talent there before this year, but it felt to me, and it's felt to me, like he is the guy who, even as a rookie, and I know how good DeForest Buckner is, and I know how good Eric Armstead's been, and I know how good, how much of a threat Dee Ford can be. But to me, already, on the best defensive line in football, the guy who the offensive coordinator is staying up at night on Saturday night before the game worrying about is number 97.
Yeah, Bosa's been a beast. And Vegas tells us a lot, Bert. And I'm looking at a NFL Defensive Rookie of the Year odds tracker. And the week of October 30th, so Halloween week, Nick Bosa went from plus 150, I think it was, on the old chart. Let me see here. He was Yeah, he was plus 125 to the next week being minus 150. And, you know, as Nick Bosa sits here right now, it's Nick Bosa minus 350 on the wagering line.
So that means you got to bet 350 to win 100.
Yes, that's exactly right. The next, in terms of odds, is Devin Bush at plus 375. So you can bet 100 to win 375 on Devin Bush, or you can lay 350 to win 100 on Nick Bosa. Vegas tells us a lot, and I think that's all we need to expound upon with Nick Bosa, because it's almost fait accompli that he'll be the defensive rookie of the year.
Okay, congratulations to Nick Bosa on that. This is going to be, I mean, to me, this is the most fun conversation as coach of the year. Ooh. And God, there are some good names this year too. I mean, I think you could even make a case for some guys who may miss the playoffs. And Brian Flores, for one, to me, is somebody who has done a fantastic job based on the hand that he was dealt. And you look at where they were coming into the year, stripping down the roster, trading Laremy Tunsil a week before the season started, and how are you going to sell a tough, demanding program without A, giving the players results, or B, having any assurances that any of those guys are going to be there past this year because you're trading away your best players. And yet he's been able to get maximum effort from those guys on a week-to-week basis, and now they're actually winning games. And they beat the team I picked to win the Super Bowl. And I know the Eagles aren't what we thought they were going to be, but they beat the Eagles on Sunday. And so I think, like, Brian Flores is somebody who deserves a hat tip here. Mike Tomlin, another one, based on the circumstances. They're 7-5 right in the playoff hunt, even without their quarterback. So he deserves a little bit of a look. I think Billy O'Brien, the job that they've done, they lose J.J. Watt for the year. They've had moving parts on the offensive line. I think he deserves a look. To me, there are three guys, though, that sort of stand out here above everyone else. John Harbaugh in Baltimore, Kyle Shanahan in San Francisco, and Sean Payton in New Orleans. And what's fascinating about this to me, Gresh, is each one of them is for different reasons. For Harbaugh, I think it's being open-minded and being innovative and being willing to change. With Kyle, I think it's just being able to bring a young team together and have them take this enormous step. In fact, it feels like they've taken two or three steps all at once. And with Sean Payton, it's managing a quarterback injury the way that they have. So it's a tough call. I'm gonna switch my pick here. I was Kyle Shanahan. I'm going to go with John Harbaugh. And the reason I'm going with John Harbaugh, again, I see the innovation on offense, and I know that's Greg Roman, but I see how open he was to innovation on offense and doing things a little bit differently. And on defense, I think an underrated story this year is how much better they've gotten over the course of the year. I mean, at the beginning of October, they were so worried about the toughness element of all of this that they cut a player, Timmy Williams, to make an example of him and say, we're not putting up with this anymore. They bring in Josh Bynes off the street. They trade for Marcus Peters. Now, all of a sudden, you look at where they are defensively. Defense isn't as much of a problem anymore. And so it's innovation on offense. It's improvement on defense. John Harbaugh by a nose over Sean Payton and Kyle Shanahan for Coach of the Year.
This is so interesting because there are two guys that you left out. When you think of this, there are two teams, one in the AFC, one in the NFC.
All right.
Both are number two seeds right now. Both lead their division. And how much will Bill Belichick and Pete Carroll not get a sniff at this award?
Right, because
no, you and I would argue this.
Because their success has become normal.
Well, yes. Yeah, in a way. I mean, look, I by the way, before I go off on the whole bigger discussion on all this, I'm going with Sean Payton in part because Sean Payton had to play without Drew Brees. And I think if New England had to play without Tom Brady right now, if Baltimore had to play without Lamar Jackson right now, if Seattle had to play without Russell Wilson right now, I don't think those teams would have been able to do what Sean Payton was able to do with Drew Brees out of the lineup. Now, that said, it's interesting that you're right. There is a take-for-granted level of success with certain coaches, and I think Pete Carroll and Bill Belichick fall into that. But if there was ever a year that Belichick were going to steal this award, I mean, think about it, Bert. With all the issues they have, right? If they beat Kansas City, you got to figure you would think they'd win out the rest of the way. Buffalo will be a challenge, there's no doubt. But in a year after losing Gronk, having guys retire, they screwed up the Antonio Brown thing. They let Josh Gordon go. If they still go 14-2 and Bill Belichick is running the defense and everyone admits that offensively they're different, what does that guy have to do to try to win that award? Like, right. If there's one year that Belichick would ever or should ever really be in the discussion,
it's every year.
Well, no, but this year more than others.
Yeah.
I mean, because look, how many teams have a Hall of Famer like Gronk walk off the field,
right,
and go through what they've gone through? And I'm not stumping for Belichick. I mean, you know, it's the
whole
everybody.
But this is the Michael Jordan NBA MVP award.
A little
from
bit.
The 90s,
I
right?
mean, and the other thing too is, you know, look, I hear what you're saying in the spirit of the while they've done a good job to get to three wins, but like we knew that Brian Flores was going in aiming for four wins this year. Like, to me, now Tomlin is an interesting case. And you mentioned Minka Fitzpatrick a little bit earlier. Hey, listen, if the Steelers are 10-6, Tomlin's got to be another guy managing without a starting quarterback and then going down to the third string quarterback at times. And they found a different way to do it. You could argue that Tomlin and Belichick, in a lot of ways, are having to manage that. I know that I'm not saying that the quarterback situation is the same. Don't get me wrong. But in terms of what they're managing and how they're trying to manage it, you know, there are some similarities there in terms of the way they're trying to win games. You know, Andy Reid, I think in the AFC it's down to two. It would be Belichick and Harbaugh with Tomlin on the outside. And in the NFC, I mean, think of this there, Bert. I had to bring up Pete Carroll. You mentioned Peyton and Shanahan. What about Matt LaFleur?
Yeah.
Who is managing maybe the most mercurial quarterback in the NFL, and that guy hasn't been bitching and moaning for the last 8 weeks.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm with you. I'm with you. I mean, I think one of the big stories coming into the year was how that relationship was going to manifest, you know? And I think LaFleur and Rodgers were both aware of it, but they came from very different places, you know, schematically, I guess is the right way to put it, because LaFleur came from a system, and this is, you know, the Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay, really Mike Shanahan system, right? And like that system, what does it do? Well, it gets the quarterback playing fast. It puts the protection calls on the center. It gives the quarterback, in a lot of cases, two play calls, you know, the double call where it's like, you see this, you go here. You see that, you go there. It's built to like take a lot of the mental load off the quarterback so the quarterback can just go out there and play. And on the flip side, you've got a quarterback who is used to having total control, who is used to running an offense, basically having the entire offense run through them. And so it's hard to marry up those two things, or at least it was in the spring. How do you marry up these two things? And so, yeah, I think LaFleur absolutely deserves credit for finding a way to marry up those things to the point where Rodgers is happy with how the offense is being run, because he clearly wasn't before.
All right, now, I don't know if this is dickish, and feel free to sidestep it since I'm the one who is throwing a curveball in here. Do we dare want to get into the coach that has done the worst job this season?
You can go ahead. Who do you think?
Oh, it's Pat Shurmur by far.
Okay.
Look, when I look at, right, so I'm looking at the standings right here, friend, okay? Arizona, first-year head coach, no real expectations, right? Dan Quinn, I give him credit. He shook it up enough to be able to sort of wake everyone up down there a little bit and at least be competitive.
Yeah.
All right. So you look at Detroit, 3-8-1. You know, they haven't had Stafford. There's been some stuff going on there. Not that, you know, Patricia's done a great job, but okay, I can look past that. Washington said, Jay Gruden, get the hell out of here. You can't put that on anyone but the owner at this point. You know, I'm looking in the AFC, and Cincinnati, come on. We knew that was a teardown from the very beginning.
Yep.
So I'm gonna leave old Zach out of this. You know, the Jets have found a way to bounce back, so I at least give Gates a little bit of credit there. But, man, oh, man, there's just one team that stands out in terms of what the hell is going on. And to me, it's the Giants. And Daniel Jones, he's had some rookie moments, but he hasn't really played like a rookie quarterback. They spent money on that offensive line. They made a trade in season to go get Leonard Williams. It looks like everything they've done there just hasn't worked. And Bert, to me, when I look at that football team, the first sign that something goes bad, to me, it's like that group just looks up in the air and goes, oh, crap, here we go again. And they don't have the confidence that the guy on the sideline is going to be able to kind of lead them out of it. And I know that there'll be a coaching carousel at the end of the year, and the Giants have some tough decisions to make. But to me, and look, this isn't a knock on the guy. It still means he's a pretty damn good coach. To me, Shurmur is a better coordinator than he is a head coach. He'd still make millions of dollars and be pretty damn famous being a longtime offensive coordinator in the NFL. No shame in that.
I think, well, first of all, it'd be interesting to see what happens there, because if Shurmur is gone, that'd be the second straight coach that's only lasted 2 years there, which is unlike the Giants. I think Matt Rhule would be a very, very interesting fit there.
Do you think Matt Rhule would want total control?
I don't think Matt Rhule wants total control, but I think after what happened with the Jets last year, he's very leery about things being sideways in any sort of way. So I think if he senses any sort of dysfunction in any organization that he may be interviewing with or may be considering, I think he's going back to Baylor. But I think that he will have multiple opportunities. I think the Giants, the Falcons, the Redskins, and I don't think he's going to go to a place where he senses any sort of dysfunction.
All right, so let's take this a step further, because you know I'm a big college guy, and you know I'm doing my college football thing this weekend around the conference championship stuff as well. So if you're a Giants fan and you want Matt Rhule, are you rooting for them to lose to Oklahoma in the Big 12 title game so that
I guess you would be, yeah, so they don't make the playoff. Yeah, I guess
right.
You would be. Yeah.
And they'd play a bowl game that in theory would be around the end of the regular season in the NFL in a way you'd be rooting for Oklahoma if you're a Giant fan and you're thinking Matt Rhule.
Unless you want Lincoln Riley.
You know what, Bert? You know, I'm really serious about this. I would not be going for the proverbial flavor of the month. Here's the reason why I go Matt Rhule over Lincoln Riley. And it's not to say Lincoln Riley isn't a great coach. Matt Rhule has built something not once but twice.
Yeah.
And that takes a different kind of discipline.
In places that were tough,
coach.
Too.
That's exactly right. That's a really good point. Temple and Baylor. Now, Baylor had some existing infrastructure, and I get the whole Art
Browns
Baylor,
thing. But Baylor was like Penn State post-Paterno when he got there.
No question, Bert. You're exactly right. And that's, you know, and all due respect to Lincoln Riley, he's very much flavor of the month, but I need more than a couple of seasons of him taking over something that Bob Stoops built. I need to know that he can sustain it. And if he can, is he going to do it with guys that he's going to recruit? Or is he going to become the fifth-year quarterback flavor of the month where all those guys go there and year to year, it's just a plug-and-play guy, and that's how he kind of keeps that program up and running. Rhule has built that thing a couple different ways, and that's why his level of patience will be different than Lincoln Riley. And Matt Rhule also knows how to manage the adversity of building something.
All right. Well, it's going to be fascinating to watch. Gresh, always appreciate you coming out.
You're a very kind man, Bert Breer. By the way, how was your Thanksgiving?
Excellent.
I know Ohio State made it good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was actually like sort of on eggshells all the way into the fourth quarter, and then I was okay.
What? So, really?
Yeah. I don't know. I've got this PTSD. Like anytime I'm rooting for a team, I think I just don't allow myself to. It's really bad. I don't allow myself to enjoy it. So.
So the Big Ten title game this weekend, you're going to be a mess.
Yeah. It won't be as bad as Michigan, though, because losing to Michigan can't happen. So,
wow. I mean, it is Wisconsin. I mean, yeah. I guess you got to give Paul Chryst credit for getting there.
No, I said you can't lose to Michigan. I mean,
but if you lose to Wisconsin, that's worse than losing to Michigan, I would think, considering the titles on board.
No, it's worse to lose to Michigan. You do not want those people squawking. You just do not.
Would you rather beat Michigan and lose the Big Ten title game than lose to Michigan and win a Big Ten championship?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying to me right now?
Yep.
Oh, dear Lord.
All right, Gresh. Appreciate you coming out.
You're the best, Bert.
All right, guys, we're going to jump in the mailbag. You guys know how this works. Every week, I put the call out for questions, but you guys can ask the question anytime during the week, and there are two ways that you guys can get to us. One is via email. That's BreerMailbag@gmail.com. Again, my last name, Breer, B-R-E-E-R, mailbag@gmail.com. Or you can call us, and you can leave a voicemail at 201-596-4346. That, again, is 201-596-4346. We're going to bring in our executive producer, Shelby Royston, now. But the question, Shelby, question number one.
From Steve, do you get the sense that John Gruden wants to move on from Derek Carr?
I think he's open to it. That's the sense I get. And I know some of their actions before the 2019 draft, sort of how they finagled it so they'd have quarterbacks on their roster at the Senior Bowl last January, how they brought in Dwayne Haskins and Kyler Murray they went and visited Dwayne Haskins and Kyler Murray on back-to-back days in March. They were looking at the quarterback class last year, no question about it. And I don't think they found somebody that they felt like would be a positive upgrade over Derek Carr. But I think the way that they look at it right now is they've got a guy who's a very good functional NFL quarterback. You can make the playoffs with him. He's proven that. John Gruden can run his offense through him. We've seen that. But they're going to be on the look for an upgrade. It's actually exactly what Mike Mayock has said on the record, too, is like, we really like Derek Carr, but as is the case at every position, if there's an upgrade out there, we're going to be open to it. So I'd say that's the way they approach it. Where they're drafting is going to affect that this year, of course, because you know, the chances are their pick, based on how they've played, and they haven't played well the last couple of weeks, but based on how they've played and where the Bears are, it seems like their two first-round picks would probably be somewhere between 10 and 20, which may be too low to get one of the top three quarterbacks. Question number two, Shelby.
From Britt. Hey, Albert, I'm from Nashville and have been a Titans fan all my life. As far back as I can remember, the Titans have struggled with finding a quarterback who can consistently be a competent face of the franchise. Tannehill's recent play has won us a lot of games, but do you think he's a next 7 to 8 years kind of guy, or should they try to draft a young QB to develop behind him?
So first of all, this person apparently wasn't around for the Steve McNair years, because Steve McNair was pretty good. I believe shared an MVP with Peyton Manning at one point. I think Tannehill is a ideal bridge type of quarterback. And I would actually be comfortable with paying him on a 2 or 3 year deal now and saying to him, look, we're not out of the quarterback market, but we like you enough where if we're not wild about one of the quarterbacks that are available to us, either in free agency or the draft, we're going to continue forward with you. And for Ryan Tannehill, and I believe 32 years old, that's not a bad option. It's a chance to play right now, make very good money, and, you know, if something happens, something happens. But I don't think Tannehill is going to do much better than that either, as well as he's played. And so I think the good news is now you found a guy that can sort of be your guy to tread water with until you find the long-term answer at the position. And look, Tannehill's another one. Like we talked about with Carr, he's a guy who's made the playoffs before as a starting quarterback. And so I think you can win with him. He's obviously done a nice job this year, and I think he's set himself up to be sort of the ideal bridge-type quarterback for the Titans. Shelby, question number three.
Have a voicemail from Anthony.
Hey, Albert, it's Anthony. I know we're all sick of talking about the NFL officiating crews this year, but I was curious if maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the evaluation process works for officials, who qualifies for playoff and Super Bowls, and how sort of the evaluation process works for them. Would love to get your insight. Thanks, man.
All right, so Anthony, basically all of that goes through Al Riveron and the officiating department. They grade all the officials on a week-to-week basis, and then playoff officials are basically selected based on those grades. And one of the arguments that they've had, that you've heard against the officials is the way that the officiating crews are set up for the Super Bowl and for the playoffs, and that's they have all-star crews. And the all-star crews the argument against them is that there's not the continuity and level of communication between those crews, which can lead to some missed calls. And we saw one in the NFC Championship game. It's the obvious one. But if you're used to working with certain people, maybe you know that person's got X, Y, and Z covered, so you have to cover A, B, and C. And the argument like there, I think, actually makes a lot of sense, that the All-Star crew isn't conducive to getting the game officiated the best way, that it would be better if you had guys who'd work together, who had an idea of how each the other guys around them works. And so that's how it's done. And that I think there's a fair criticism about the way the playoffs are officiated because of that. But to answer your question again, number one, this all goes through the officiating department in New York. That's how the officials are graded. Number two, the playoff officials are selected based on their grades, and all-star crews are assembled. Shelby, question number four.
From David, every week I watch Lamar Jackson play, I'm reminded of running QBs who have not lasted in the league or have been limited in their play because of injury. Robert Griffin, Cam Newton, even Drew Bledsoe when he was hit by Mo Lewis. Do you have any concerns with how the Ravens use Lamar, particularly with so many runs up the middle?
Yeah, I have some concern over it. I think that there's no question that sustainability is the biggest question with him. And I don't think it's schematic sustainability. I think it's medical sustainability. He's done a good job of protecting himself. And generally on designed runs, you can find ways to protect your quarterback. The fact that they've run in between the tackles tells you they're okay with him taking some hits that way. Is it sustainable over the long term? It's an open question that I don't think anybody has the answer to. I don't have the answer to it. Other people don't have the answer to it. The good news for him is that he doesn't have the injury history that some of these guys had coming out of college, right? And if you look at it, and it's really interesting, I look back at this over the last 10 years, the guys who got hurt in college wound up continuing to get hurt. Sam Bradford in 2010, Jake Locker in 2011, Robert Griffin in 2012, Marcus Mariota in 2015, Carson Wentz in 2016, Deshaun Watson in 2017. All those guys had major injuries as collegians. All those guys wound up having major injuries as pros. And so the one positive here with Lamar is that he hasn't had the major injury that some of these guys have had, which would lend you to believe that maybe his body is built differently and he's able to hold up a little bit better. He also does a good job of protecting himself. But yeah, absolutely, there's no question. When your quarterback's ninth in the league in rushing, there is a level of concern there that that you're going to have to manage the damage at some point. He's young now too, which helps. I mean, look, best example of it's Cam Newton. 6'5", 270 pounds, built like a defensive end. And even he's now going through it. So long term, yes. Short term, I think you just keep your eye on it. Shelby, question number five.
From Tyler, how would you evaluate Buffalo at this point in the season? Are they a genuine threat in the playoffs or just feasting on bad teams?
Love their plan. Love the way they've set it up. Love how well coached the team is. Going into that Dallas game, they were 7-1 against teams with losing records. The one loss was to a 5-6 Cleveland team, and they were 1-2 against teams with winning records. The one win was over a 6-5 Tennessee team. So they've been remarkably consistent. What that tells me is they're playing to their level each and every week. So they're incredibly well coached, and I think that their consistency in that way is a hallmark of it. I also like the way that they've built from a personnel standpoint. That first year, they hold on to a lot of the older players that had been there. They bring them back. They make the playoffs. Sean McDermott was pouring a foundation, and he was basically allowing everybody to know, here's the expectations. We're going to be tough with X, Y, and Z. And you know what happened? What happened was the players got tangible results for following the program. So that's in everybody's memory, right? Then they go through the necessary step of tearing the place down the next year and ripping the Band-Aid off and taking care of some of the cap issues. And about a third of their salary cap was devoted to players who weren't on the team because they eventually were going to have to pay off all the debt that they had that had been built up in the Doug Whaley, Rex Ryan era. And so they went ahead and did that. They drafted their quarterback. They drafted a leader for their defense in Tremaine Edmonds. They had their issues in 2018, but that foundation from 17 remained. And now you've got the younger players growing up, and you've got sensible free agent signings, guys like Cole Beasley and Mitch Morse and John Brown. It's just, I like everything about the way that they've built that team. A lot's going to come down to how far Josh Allen can go, but I just, you know, I look at the way they've drafted with guys like Tre'Davious White and Tremaine Edmonds and Ed Oliver and Matt Milano and Josh Allen and Dawson Knox. And I like the way that they've, you know, again, been prudent in how they spend their free agent money. I think the Buffalo Bills are going places. I don't think they're there yet, but I think this is sort of a preview of what they're going to be down the line. Shelby, question number 6.
Voicemail from Matt.
Hey, this is Matt from Folsom, and I was just calling about a Raiders question. Just want to know if there was any chance the team would ever be sold, and if it were sold, if it would be a better ownership situation. It just seems like the Raiders run out of money all the time and don't have the spending flexibility of a lot of other teams. So in any event, I love your podcast. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate it. The one thing that's sort of interesting here is the estate tax situation, which has been something that everybody's sort of kept an eye on between Mark Davis and his mother, Carol. So like, there's always been sort of this feeling that forced the Raiders to sell. Forced the Davis family eventually to sell. And I've been told in the past there's a plan for it. Whether or not, you know, it's sustainable, I think, is going to be interesting. But, you know, getting the stadium publicly financed in Las Vegas certainly helps, and it'll help make them more solvent. I don't think Mark Davis has any intention of selling the team. And I understand what you're saying, and, you know, that they would be maybe run a little bit differently. That said, I think that they've got good people in charge there now too. Like, you know, Mark Bedain on the business side, you know, helped to engineer the move to Las Vegas, which I think speaks well of him from a business standpoint. And then Mike Mayock and John Gruden, I know they haven't played well the last couple of weeks, but that to me, like you see the progress they've made this year, the rookies they drafted. I mean, I think a lot of that's real. And so I understand what you're saying. I look at the free agents they've signed too. I mean, I don't know, you can make the argument that spending's been the problem when they go and it was with Mac, but like what they've done since, you know, they began a free agency, bring in guys like Trent Brown and Tyrell Williams and LaMarcus Joyner. So they've spent too. So I think the Davis family's intention is to keep the team. I think it's really all there is in Mark Davis' life. And so my guess is the team won't be sold. That's it. All right. Thanks, Shelby. I appreciate it. That's Shelby, our producer. And I always appreciate you guys coming out and want your feedback, because we always try to incorporate your feedback into what we do here. There are different ways you guys can get to me, and one of them is through social media, on my Twitter, at Albert Breer, on my Facebook, at Albert R. Breer, on my Instagram, at Albert_Breer. The other way you can get to us is you can leave us a rating and review on iTunes, which we always appreciate, because that helps the algorithm, is what they tell me. And my podcast, again, is part of the MMQB NFL podcast. You guys can get all of our podcasts on one feed now. Jenny and Connor's podcast pops on Wednesdays. We got the Monday morning podcast. We got the gambling podcast. We're all on one heading now, all on one feed. And you can get that in the MMQB news podcast feed, which is your bite-sized 5-minute, like, here's what's happening today for the ride home. That's that podcast. You can get both those podcasts on Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. I'll see you guys then.